Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Coming to the middle of the rain retreat, you've been had the opportunity to walk in the footsteps of the Buddha, of the Lord Buddha. So ask yourself exactly how far you've come, what sort of progress you've made, and if there hasn't been much progress, to ask why. The what they call the sapaya, the supporting conditions, are just about all here. It just needs the effort, the commitment, and the ability to find the skillful means to succeed in one's goal. But if you haven't got a goal, if you are still not really concerned with developing deep meditation and finding out wisdom, then obviously that there will be no progress. The desire for the goal has to come first, and that has to be maintained. If you just maintain that desire for the goal, then eventually you have to reach that goal. A matter of time, that's all. That's a confidence I hope you should have in the Buddha's teachings. Without that sadha, without that indriya of confidence, then you'll find that the practice will not achieve very much. And in this rains retreat that I've stressed again and again, just the development of the peaceful mind. And I stress the development of the peaceful mind not just because that we wish to emphasize samatha, not just because we want to attain jhana just for their own sake, but as like a good goal for which one can strive for, and a means of measuring your wisdom, your understanding of the defilements, your understanding of the Dhamma. As said here before, and it's a very meaningful teaching, that the measure of your understanding of the Buddha's teaching, the measure of your knowledge of the Dhamma, is not how many suttas you can quote. Not your understanding of Pali. It's not whether you can write books and articles and dispute with others and be right. It's the measure of your understanding of the Buddha's teachings. It's the measure of peace in your citta. The degree of like evenness, quietness, silence, lack of affliction, the happiness inside the mind. Your wisdom is measured by the amount that you have renounced the world, renounced the sensory pleasures of the world, the five sense pleasures. The more you've renounced, the more you can say that you are wise in terms of the Buddha's teachings. Again and again the Buddha pronounced on the dangers of the five sensory pleasures, the five sense organs, and just how much time we waste trying to find some satisfaction or pleasure in that area. And the fact that if one renounces those five sensory pleasures, one is renouncing the karma dhatu or the karma loka. One is renouncing a whole world, and one is going instead to the world of the mind, and one is experiencing release. The more one can experience release in the world of the five senses and the thoughts which go about that world of the five senses, the more one can experience peace, that inner sense of ease. And the more you can feel that inner sense of ease and the inner peace, the more you have confidence an inspiration that you are indeed walking in the footsteps of the Lord Buddha, of the Arahats and all the Aryans. You're experiencing the same states of mind that they experienced. And that is why that I teach and encourage these quiet states of mind. Those states which are on the way into jhanas, and the jhanas themselves, and those states after jhana, because they are a measuring stick by which you can gauge your progress. Insight is just so hard to gauge just by itself. You think you know, and you can look at the suttas and find interesting passages which support your theories. You can have a great understanding and give inspiring talks and then disrobe and go and get married, which I've seen happen many times. If your wisdom is only on the surface, it's not the real wisdom, which can only be known if it produces the ending, even if it's only temporary ending, of the defilements which cause the lack of inner stillness, the lack of inner peace, the lack of the inner ease. So it's the measurement of one's wisdom is how peaceful one can live in this monastery, how deeply one can meditate. In order to assist the development of these peaceful states then, it does require a lot of wisdom. It does require a lot of insight, just in the way in to jhanas. There is no samatha without insight, without understanding the ways of the mind. And this evening I wanted to encourage just the use of insight in order to develop peaceful states of mind. In particular, repeating roughly a talk I gave a few years ago, on developing certain perceptions throughout the day which will encourage one to renounce, to let go of what is a burden and a disturbance for the mind. And by developing those perceptions, those ways of looking, that if one is doing it properly, it should develop the peaceful mind. And you can do this throughout the day, or especially you can do it while you're meditating, while you're following those steps of anapanasati, the mindfulness of the breath, to incorporate these perceptions, to give the mindfulness some sharpness, some penetration, so you can dive into peaceful states using the power of wisdom. The sorts of perceptions which you can develop, and even like start with anicca sanya, just the perception of the impermanent nature of things, the uncertain nature of things. Just one of the other monks was commenting some weeks ago that reminded me that as a young monk that I was an expert on the Vinaya, and I could quote many passages and I could argue cases with great authority. I've forgotten most of that now. All that, recollect all that effort and time which I put in researching, you know, the hours, and going not just through the Pali but the Thai translation, the Thai translation of the commentary, which is excruciating Thai, just to read it was so terse and used some very old language, but I had to learn my way through that so that I could understand what the translators were saying, so I could understand some of what the commentary was trying to say. It took a great deal of effort just to learn all of that, and just even for one little point of Vinaya, sometimes you'd read through hours trying to find what you were looking for. There were no indexes to the Thai translation of the commentary, and I used to go and read the whole lot of it just to make sure that I didn't miss anything. Hours, days. Forgotten it all now. What a waste of time when you really come to think about it. all that sort of knowledge, that external knowledge, was impermanent. And it's also uncertain. Sometimes you research something and you think you had it right. Sometimes you'd be wrong. Sometimes there'd be some aspect of it you didn't see, and someone would point that out to you. Sometimes you would be right, but no one would believe you. So, what was the point of it all? But these external knowledge is anicca, is impermanent and uncertain. And if you wish to build up your practice on such knowledge, and on just such knowledge alone, rather than realizing this is a tool which you have to use to develop peaceful states of mind, not just as a tool for disputation, not just as a tool for thinking that you are someone in the Sangha, that you are knowledgeable, that you are the expert. In fact, I warn any of you, if you are an expert, please don't tell anybody. Because if you keep telling anybody, you'll get lots of letters back, people asking you questions on very defined points of vinaya, which never come up in practice anyhow. And you waste a lot of time, waste a lot of valuable time. Now you have a good body, a healthy body, you're a monk, you have all of the supporting conditions. Don't waste this opportunity on investigations which are not leading to the goal. A certain amount of knowledge of the vinaya is required. Like anything else, it can go overboard. A certain knowledge of the written Dhamma is essential. But again, one can go overboard on nitpicking points. All these things are in the realm of anicca. The Dhamma is, and I'm going to pick a Mahayana simile which I approve of for a change, which is a finger pointing at the moon. Now, all those teachings are just for that. They're supposed to be asking you to do something. When you do the anicca sanya, the perception of the impermanent, if you keep that in mind and sustain that perception, you'll find that most of that which we call knowledge is just thinking. It's just like words which we keep repeating in our mind. And we support them with more arguments and more words. But they're never true. They never really get to the point of it. They just go round in circles. And as one of the monastics here made the point in an interview a few days ago, there's a lot of difference between thinking and knowing. If you can know that difference, you know just how unreliable thinking is. And that knowing is the only way that you can find the real truth of things. Get to the real data, not what you conceive the data to be, not how you interpret the data, not how you intellectualize it, but get to the real data of experience. Whether it's thoughts, whether it's perceptions, whether it's sensory objects, anicca or impermanent, everything in the outside world you're going to have to let go of. All of your knowledge, all of your notes, all of your books eventually have to be burnt, gone. Sooner the better. The anicca sanya, or not only just the objects of the mind such as possessions, but also some of the moods in the mind as well. Sometimes you may be sitting meditating and thinking you're getting nowhere. Just whatever state of mind you're in, to know that is impermanent, it can't last. And just if you can watch the aspects of that state of mind as impermanent, it's fading, it's changing, it's always altering. And it gives you the sense of not wanting to control it, not wanting to possess it. But just being this thing which I keep on saying, being the passive watcher of all of this thing. This whole world, what you're perceiving, what you're conceiving, what your consciousness of, is continually just breaking apart, breaking apart, with nothing solid. To develop that anicca samya until it feels as if you've got nothing to stand on at all, not even any point of view to stand on, not even any concept to stand on, not even any person to stand on. Just to see this anicca samya just goes so deep that everything which you hold dear, everything which you've based your perceptions and conceptions, even your consciousness on, all of that tends to crumble away and disappear. Allow it to crumble away. If it's an emotion like fear comes up, allow fear to crumble away. It's all impermanent. It's all changing. It's all disappearing in front of your very eyes. With the anicca samya, hopefully you can also develop the viraga samya as well. Actually, to see all of these things just fading away, fading away, fading away. It's nice to do the viraga samya, things fading away. I like to watch all of the letters on my desk fading away, all the business fading away, all the problems fading away. If you just put your attention on arising, arising, then it gets hopeless, because there's always things arising. It's much more fun watching things fade away and cease. I much prefer watching the ending of things rather than the beginning of things. I don't want to start to build another monastery. I want to see this one just break apart. I just want to see this body break apart. I see this mind break apart. To the end of this samsara, not the beginning of new things. I want to see the end of projects, the fading away of things, not the beginning of more things. How often is it that we put all our attention on beginning things and just give ourselves more burdens, more duties, more responsibilities, more things to look after, instead of putting our attention on viraga samya, the fading away, the ending of all of the duties, the burden of being. Anicca samya and viraga samya are very beautiful perceptions. If you manage to do these perceptions when you're meditating, if it's thinking which is going on in your mind and being the burden, watch it as impermanent and watch it fade away. If you have that perception in mind, viraga samya, you might notice it actually happening. Just the power of thought just gets weaker and weaker. There's this impermanent, uncertain, untrue, untrustworthy. Just allow it just to fade away completely. By doing that sanya, by putting that sanya in your mind, you find it's a way of actually happening. Sanya is such that whatever sanya you choose, you tend to see. Remember the simile which I've given before, like sanya is just like the choosing the different packets of soap powder on the supermarket shelf. Whichever one you want to choose, they're all up there. And sanya just chooses the one you want. Very often, sanya just chooses from habit. It's the same old soap powder you buy every week. Not that it's the best or the cheapest, it's just habit, that's all. That sanya is just full of habit. But if you, instead of like following the old habits of sanya, you do the new habits of sanya, and you choose from the shelf, the supermarket shelf, viraga sanya. And actually, that's what actually the mind takes up. Whatever it sees things just fading away and disappearing. It sees thought just disappearing. It sees all the concern for the sensory world just disappearing. It is the sound which disturbs you. Not just anicca, because anicca is what rises and falls away and rises again. That's anicca. Viraga is that fades and disappears. And see your interest in these disturbances like fade away. As you become more attuned to the actual process of fading rather than what's happening out there, what's disturbing you. You start just to allow just the mind to settle down, because the quiet states of mind are the result of many things disappearing, fading away. To allow the body to fade away. The body is impermanent, you can see it sort of always changing, but to see it fade away is just so beautiful. Just, you know, the legs just fading away, the arms, the back, the head, just everything just fading, fading, fading. This is like the way of developing renunciation. Renunciation is not just renouncing, you know, your ability to go to the cinema and go and come where you please. It's not just renouncing money. Renunciation is renouncing the body. Renouncing the body. You know, the forest Ajahns used to term it like being willing to sit meditation and die. And have the whole body sort of die. I like to look upon it as when it fades away, it's dead from the consciousness. And what is dead is something which is not working anymore. It has disappeared, faded away into the elements. Not your business anymore. When something is dead, we go and burn it, we throw it away. When you meditate, you imagine your body is just dead. Throw it away, renounce it, allow it to fade. If you can develop these sorts of perceptions, the result should be peacefulness. It should be a release from something. It's in the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta. The Buddha was describing all of these five khandhas as an abhada, as an affliction, as a burden. It's strange why people keep on picking up this burden of the body, picking up the burden of thought, picking up the burden of like intellectual knowledge, picking up the burden of the projects, always wanting to do more. Some. Whereas one's object should be renouncing, giving away, lessening one's burden, and at the same time lessening my burden as well. Once one can lessen the burden, see all these things fade away. The result of that is peace, happiness. With prasadikaya and prasadajitta, a quiet body and a peaceful mind. The way to experience a peaceful mind is through letting go of these things. They won't go just by themselves, just by watching them with mindfulness, just seeing them come and go. You have to do something. To do something like the viraga sanya, to allow these things just to fade away. Or even the anatta sanya, which is a very powerful perception to develop in all stages of your day and your monastic life, and especially in meditation. Whether you're walking on the meditation path, it's just the body walking, it's not you. The body is not yours. It doesn't belong to you, the body is part of the body. It's part of nature, it's part of the four elements. To see the four elements walking up and down. To see it like a skeleton, just covered with flesh. Experience your skeleton. To feel the bones there, and perceive yourself just like that, just as a skeleton. And that's more like the asupasanya, the unbeautiful perception. To be able to develop that asupasanya, just going off from anattasanya, maybe start with asupasanya instead. To be able to see all the people who come into the monastery, the old ladies and the beautiful young ladies. The young men, the old men, even the kangaroos, the birds, to see them all, the skeleton, the cats. To be able to develop that perception, which is there on the supermarket shelf, as it were, for you to pick out. If you can do that, it's very useful, it's very beneficial. You find that whatever person, no matter how attractive or ugly, they're looked upon in the same way. Just a skeleton with skin covering it. if one develops the supasanya, the perception of the beautiful, in the realm of the five senses, it's provocative of lust, of desire, I want this, it will stir you up. If you allow your mind to go into that area, there's no way you'll be able to develop deep meditation. If that's what you're doing, then you can't hope to get to the deep meditation and to taste what the Buddha was asking you to enjoy, you know, the blisses of the releases of the mind. And try and develop the asupasanya regard to the people, so that even if you go into town, if you go into Nolamara, wherever you go, you can see people just in a way that they don't attract you anymore. So that instead of the mind being taken out, drawn out into the world and into afflictions, into trouble, into suffering, into more rebirth, you can resist all of that and develop the ability to keep your mindfulness inside, at home, in the mind. The asupasanya is so important, especially for young and middle monks, maybe carers as well, in order to protect you and to free you. You know what happens, the simile of the bait, just the fisherman with the hook and little worm on the top. It looks so beautiful, the asupasanya doesn't come up. You don't see that that's going to cause you problem. There's also the adinavasanya, the perception of the dangers in these things. The perception of the danger in food, the perception of the danger in sensual fantasies, the perception of the danger in too much sleep, the perception of the danger in too much talking. This is one of the other perceptions which one should develop. That's actually in the Girimandana Sutta, the perception of danger, the disadvantage. If you don't perceive the danger in these things, you'll get caught up. You get caught up in these things. I just recall the other day, because we were talking about funeral services in Thailand, when Ajahn Chah's preceptor passed away. Well, I was in Wat Nanachat at the time. His preceptor lived in the village of Bung Wai. And Ajahn Chah invited all the Western monks, because we had been looking after that old preceptor Ajahn Chah, going to do some acharyavata, the duties to a teacher towards him in the village. We all went over for his funeral to join in the chanting. And after the chanting was finished and the body was put on the pyre to be burnt, Ajahn Chah stayed for another half an hour talking to some lay people, so we stayed as well. And when we left, the party was already underway. Funerals in the village monasteries in Thailand, they get the unpleasant stuff out of the way as soon as possible, and then they have their party. And I just passing, I was very well restrained. I was practicing sense restraint. I knew there was all sorts of entertainments going on, and I was keeping my eyes to the ground. But I heard this Western music, and I looked up, and it was a stage with dancing girls on from the town, and these old poor orcs, these 60 and 70 year old men, had paid a baht, or maybe a baht 50, to go up and dance with these little floozies from Ubon. It's quite pathetic really, but just going up and looking, as soon as I saw sort of one of these girls dressed in makeup and a beautiful dress, I put my eyes down straight away. But it wasn't enough. It wasn't good enough, because that night I had a dream, a wet dream, about those girls. Just one moment of lack of restraint was enough to bring up lust like that, and lust which reverberated throughout the night. A supasanya is just so important. The worms dangling on the hook are just there all over the place. If you don't have a supasanya and a dinavasanya. You're going to not only lose the opportunity to live happily in monastic life, you're also going to lose the opportunity to taste these beautiful jhanas. Develop these perceptions to the point that you can look up and see a beautiful lady and not have the least bit of lust, the least bit of attraction towards them, even to be feel a little bit of repulsion, to see the danger in even thinking about sexual matters or sensual matters, to do the same with the food you eat, the asupa nadinavasanya. You eat too much food, you just get all sleepy, you get fat, you get sloppy. Just eat the right amount, enough to keep you going for another day. Remember those reflections which each one of you is supposed to do every day. Reflection on the four requisites. What this food is for. It's only for, it's for living the holy life, for doing the meditation, for developing the Eightfold Path, which includes developing energy, effort, right mindfulness, and samadhi, jhanas, for developing renunciation. That's what this food, it comes with a price. It doesn't come free. This is not sort of a freeloading monastery. If you eat this food, if you live in these huts, if you use these requisites, you have to do something. You have to work hard. People in the world work hard. They don't get their money for free. Even now the dole, apparently you have to work for the dole, let alone for working in a job. Are you working that hard, as hard as a lay person works? If not, do you really deserve their food and the requisites which they give? As a monk you should be working harder, putting even more effort in than a lay person does, because they respect you. The energy which you expound in your practice, expend in your practice, should exceed that of a labourer, of a person working in an office or wherever. If you can do this, then you're reflecting on the use of the requisites. Now the food is there for a purpose. The robes you wear, they're not just to look good, they're just there to protect the body, so again you can live the holy life. And the hut, and other requisites you have in the hut. What have you got all those requisites in the hut for? The hut is there for you to practice meditation, for you to develop yourself, to be someone who's worthy of requisites. In other words, to become a stream enterer at least. Develop all of these qualities which the Buddha said are there for the taking. If you just get off your bed and just sit and walk and sit and walk and do the practice. And the medicines, again, not just for enjoyment and indulgence, it's there to help your meditation. You can have tea in your hut, but it's not just to have fun. Remember Ajahn Chah would not allow to have tea and coffee or anything in your hut. And at the beginning of every rains retreat, I remember Ajahn Liam coming around with the cart, and everyone had to put in their kettles and their thermoses and everything else which had accumulated in out of the rain season. And you just had water, that's all. So in this monastery, I allow some tea and coffee in your hut, but use it wisely. Use it just for helping you with your meditation, give you a bit of energy in the afternoon, but not just for indulging. If you're using it for indulging, you don't belong here. If it's just for increasing your sense pleasures, then it's not the right way of using it. Reflect on the use of the requisite, what you're here for, what you're doing this for, and then it becomes a perception which will actually lead to this goal. The adinavasanya, the danger Look at the danger of rebirth. Now this lifetime you're in a pretty good rebirth. A lifetime where there's a lot of physical comfort. There's no wars or pestilence. You don't know where you might be reborn next time. One of the similes from the suttas, which I like very much, is a simile of the stick, where the Buddha said karma is like throwing up a stick. One end is good karma, one end is bad karma. You don't know which end is going to land on. Even people like monks, good monks, monks who've built monasteries, who've done a lot of good karma, that's just only in this life. When they die, it's uncertain, unless they're Aryas. It's uncertain which realm they'll be reborn in. If you're not a stream enterer yet, or above, you don't know what realm you get reborn in next time, no matter how much merit you make, no matter how much loving kindness you develop. Even if you develop jhanas, it's still uncertain. Because when the stick is thrown up, there's always that chance that bad karma from the previous existence will become predominant and you get reborn in an unpleasant realm. But you can only see the danger of samsara, this uncertainty, and the danger in the fact that you don't know how many more days you have to live. Everyone I know who's died, with very few exceptions, never expect they will die today. They always think tomorrow or next week, mostly in a few years' time. Nearly all of you here, the day before you die, you will not expect it. It could be today is the day before you die. The Marana Sanya is a very beautiful perception, if you do it properly. Even in Christian monasteries, there's one Christian group which every time they go to bed at night, they reflect on Marana Sanya, the perception of death. As they go to sleep, they think, maybe I will not wake up in the morning. Maybe this is my last night. Reflecting on that, it's very hard to be heedless. If you reflect on your death, the imminence of your death, it can happen any time. You know the Buddha's teaching on Marana Sanya, not just tonight, but in the next breath. The monk who saw that in the next breath he could die was the monk who the Buddha said really understood how to do Marana Sati, the mindfulness of death. It's amazing how mindful you can become, how awake you can become, how clear you can become when you're about to die. If you can develop that intensity in the practice by using Marana Sanya, you find again the mind doesn't get lost in defilements, in hindrances. These are skillful tools which help the meditation along. You develop the Marana Sanya, then you find energy is very easy to rouse. When you go to bed tonight, when you lay down there, imagine that you're in a coffin. Imagine that all the people, your relations, your friends, are standing around. The monks are reciting the chants around your body, your dead body, the end of your life. Have you used your time wisely? You know, one of the reflections for one who's gone forth at the end of your life, it's in the 10 reflections. They say that at the end of your life, when your wise companions in the holy life, the wise companions in the holy life, ask you, have you achieved any Uttari Manusa Dhamma? Any stages worthy of one who's gone forth, the jhana, or stream entry, once returner, non-returner, arahat, you haven't received any of these things, then you should feel ashamed in front of your friends. That's one of the reflections for one who's gone forth. These are ways to stimulate energy, to stimulate aspiration, to be able to point the mind, encourage the mind. I've told many people in the interviews that the difference between a Putucana and an Arya is paper thin. You can just punch through at any time. It's ignorance, illusion, delusion. It's just making you wander around that side of the paper. It's so thin. It can happen at any time. It needs just confidence, perseverance. And then eventually it will happen. It has to happen. This is the Dhamma, the promise of the Buddha. The problem with monks is they don't try hard enough, they don't aspire. They lose faith in themselves, they're not confident enough that it can be done. They don't use enough of these skillful means which the Buddha laid down, all these different types of perceptions. I did actually talk earlier on the Anatta Sanya, but I never really developed that because I got sidetracked in my talk talking about Asupa Sanya. But Anatta Sanya again is an extremely powerful way of looking at the world, of contemplating. When you're on the meditation path, it's Anatta Sanya, walking backwards and forwards. This isn't me, this isn't mine, this isn't the self. And look at the body, this isn't mine, it's nothing to do with me, just something I rent. It's something which came from my mother, through my father, which will go eventually back to the funeral directors, will end up in Karakata or Fremantle, if you stay in Australia long enough. It's not mine. So all the aches and the pains, even that the tiredness at night when you want to go to sleep, why are you bothering about this tiredness in the body? It has nothing to do with you, it's just the body. Just carry on sitting, carry on walking. The aches and the pains in the body, in the back, in the knees, in the legs, is that your pain? If you can disassociate with this, this is just pain, not my pain. This is just body, not my body. It's practicing renunciation, giving up, giving away. The idea of mine, of possessing, of owning, is the opposite of renunciation. The Anatta Sanya is, it gets very close to Nekama Sanya, the perception of renouncing, giving away. As you do Anatta Sanya, not mine, not mine, not mine, not mine. Look at the possessions in your heart. Are they yours? Not mine, not mine, not mine. Give them away. Empty. Give up. Because you have nothing, and express having nothing by being a monk with few possessions. A simple monk. A monk who expresses their wisdom and understanding of Anatta by being a monk who owns a little. Because you know that none of this is mine. When these thoughts and ideas in your head, which you think is my idea, my thought, my view, all of these things, these thoughts and ideas and views which go in your head, who do they belong to? Whose are they? When you realize they're just like clouds just blowing across the sky. They're impermanent, they fade away, they don't belong to you. What doesn't belong to you, you should allow just to disappear and fade away. You're allowed to throw away. All that's not yours is not your business. The words and sounds outside your hut, nothing to do with you, it's not your sounds. Leave them alone. Let the crows crow, let the frogs croak, nothing to do with you. I've said before that when I sit meditation in my hut, I'm not the abbot. I'm not a monk, I'm not a man, I'm not a teacher. And someone comes into my hut and I talk to them, then I'm a teacher. When I come up here and sit on this chair, then I'm a teacher. I'm just playing games, just a role. But anatta means this is not me. And the more you can develop anatta sanya, especially in whatever role you have in this monastery, whether it's an anagarika, whether it's an ajahn, or somewhere in between, when you can develop anatta sanya, not me, not mine, nothing to do with the self, it means that you are free from a great burden. What is mine? We want to control our body. If you think it's yours, you'll always be wanting to control it, trying to get it comfort, trying to get its own way, wheedling, manoeuvring, trying to get some sort of happiness with the body. And your mind, wheedling, controlling, trying to get some sort of happiness. If you can let go of the controller, of the doer, through penetrating the perception of not mine, not me, not a self, then these things fade away by themselves. You know, trying to watch the breath, these other distractions which may come up, you know, your family, my mother, my grandmother, my auntie, my brother, not your family. That's just conventional dhammas. You haven't got a family. Anatta. Nothing belongs to you. And it's marvelous to be someone who hasn't got a husband, someone who hasn't got a wife, someone who hasn't got a brother, someone who hasn't got parents, someone who hasn't got children, someone who's really alone in the whole world, hasn't got anyone, hasn't even got a friend to bother you, let alone an enemy. Not mine, not mine. Developing the feeling about solitude. Not even got a body, not even got a mind. To be able to let the whole lot disappear. The perceptions of family, the perceptions of having things. This is what causes the burden. If you can develop this perception of anatta again and again and again, as you're walking on the path, this doesn't belong to me, this is not mine, this hut is not mine, this monastery is not mine, this body is not mine, this thought is not mine, this ache and pain is not mine. If it's done properly, it should give rise to stillness, things disappearing, disturbances just settling down. And especially in the deeper parts of meditation, anatta sanya becomes quite crucial. You're just watching the breath. Look at the breath, this is not mine. Sometimes we think this is our breath. It's the air which comes out, belongs to space. It just comes in to visit, and it goes out again pretty quickly. It's not yours at all. If it was yours, try and hold it inside you and see how long you can hold it and claim it for your own. It just goes out quickly and some more comes in. Just visitors. It's not your breath. You just watch it passively. You try and control it, it starts to get upset at you and starts to become troublesome. You leave it alone and it's reasonably peaceful. There comes a time in the meditation when you have to even leave the breath alone. If you think the breath is yours and you depend upon the breath for your life, that sort of attachment to the breath, you can't let it go and go on to the nimitta. There's that doer inside of you, that which does. It is also part of the illusion of a self. Whenever you sort of see that doer manifest inside your mind with a thought of I should do this or I should do that, use anatta sanya to stop that disturbance of the mind. the doer, always interfering. When the breath becomes manifest and the mind is reasonably still, you don't need to do anything else. Just the natural process will happen if you can stop the doer disturbing you. Jhanas are all about giving up disturbances. The gradual nirodha, the gradual cessation of things, is what jhanas are all about. This will allow the doer to disappear through anatta sanya. If you're getting stuck just watching the beautiful breath and nothing else happens, put a little bit of anatta sanya there. There's no one inside here. No one owns this. It's just nature, that's all. Just like the sun. The sun can set and disappear. So can the breath. There's no one in here doing anything. So what is all this talking about? What is all this doing and controlling? Let go of the whole lot. Whenever you penetrate to anatta, to non-self, then there's no doing. When there's no doing, that which creates the disturbances so it disappears. Things settle down. You leave the world of the five senses and go to the world of the mind. Just knowing, pure knowing, without thought, without the apparatus of the doer. Thought is just part of the doer. That's how the doer expresses itself. This is just knowing. And you let the doer go away. You've experienced a little bit of the truth of anatta, of non-self. You've experienced some viraga. You've experienced some nirodha. So if you've been doing any of these sorts of sanyas at the beginning, when you're experiencing the jhana, that sanya is so strong. And when you emerge afterwards, this viraga sanya, what will come up as a jnana very quickly is that was viraga. You're doing anicca sanya. That was anicca. Something not just rose and passed away and rose again. It rose, passed away, and stayed, passed away. Nirodha sanya, anatta sanya. If you've gone into a jhana practicing anatta sanya, when you come out again, anatta sanya will be very strong. You look back upon that state with anatta sanya. Just the way you're looking, what you're choosing from the supermarket shelves, the aspect of that experience which you're looking at. And then you've got a great chance not just to appreciate the jhana and what it actually was, but a great chance to penetrate the Dhamma. To see through experience, through thought, through reflective understanding, and looking back on what's actually happened, you've got a chance of penetrating to these great truths which the Buddha taught. Rupang anatta, sanya, vedana anatta, sanya, sankara, vinyanang anatta, all of these things. Actually to see something which has disappeared and thereby know that could not have been self. Whichever sanya which you choose to use, these are all skillful means. If you've been having difficulty with your meditation, then try using one of these sanyas. There's a couple of the sanyas I haven't mentioned, or one of them which I like to mention, is which I do a lot, is the Tunhibhava sanya. Just the perception of silence, of keeping quiet. It's like the silent perception. Because sometimes in your meditation there might be just too much inner speech going on. And if you can only develop the perception of silence, perception of silence, perception of silence, if you develop that perception, You find that when you sit and watch the breath, it's more easy to watch it in silence. Just the way you train the mind, that's all. Train the mind in not speaking. A lot of people, the only perception they have is perception of noise, perception of ideas, perception of thoughts. Even remember meeting one person years ago when I said, talk to them about meditation and say that, you know, the mind gets very peaceful and the thinking stops, that she said, oh, you're unconscious. I said, no, he said, you're quite very aware but you're not thinking. He said, that's impossible. And this lady could not even conceive of a state where you are completely awake but not even a thought is running through your mind. You're not conceptualizing or even naming at all. But if you can develop like the perception of silence, it's something you can do in your heart on your meditation path, when you're eating your meal, even when other people are talking, you can still develop perception of silence, the silence in your mind. And develop that, train yourself in that, make much of that. And this is just another skillful means which you can use to assist your meditation. A way of meditation is having many skillful means. And these are all skillful means, many of them taught by the Buddha, which you can use. And if you use it properly, it will have an almost immediate effect of lessening the disturbances, not just in your meditation, but in your daily life in the monastery. Develop all of these sannyas, and any others which you like to invent for yourself, which create the sort of peaceful mind. Not only will you develop samatha and the jhanas, but you'll also develop great insight, turning the mind in the right direction, training it, and gaining some of the fruits which you deserve to taste. Remember Ajahn Chah used to say again and again in Wat Pa Phong, he said, I've just planted all these fruit trees for you. I've done the work and all you need to do is just to wait for the fruit to drop. And that's what the Buddha has done. He's planted all these fruit trees for you. Just go stay in the orchard. Do what the Buddha has taught you to do, with energy, with commitment. And it's only a matter of time when the ripe fruit just drops into your lap. And you can taste stream entry, you can taste one's return and non-return, you can taste arahat, you can taste all the jhanas. It's there for you if you develop the mind. So this evening I gave a bit of a rambling talk about the different sannyas, the perception which you should train yourself in to develop jhanas, to develop insight. So may you persevere in the development of these sannyas. Has anyone got any comments about this evening's talk? Viraga sanya, does it fade away into what? Fade away into nothing? It's the viraga sanya fades away into something more sublime. If, for example, if you are doing breath meditation, then there is any sort of disturbance, such as thought, and you do viraga sanya towards that thinking. But then when that thinking fades away, you're left first of all with not just the perception of the breath, but the perception of the absence of thinking, the peace. And then you can take up the breath surrounded by that peace. The perception or the experience after any viraga is the perception of the absence of that thing. And with the absence of what's faded away would also be the perception of like relief. the happiness, the piti sukha, if you like, of the absence of something which was burdening you. Just like a person who's been had a rucksack on their back and they take it off. As Ajahn Chah used to say, like a person who's had a rope tied around their neck and pulled tight by two strong people. When that rope is loosened, when it fades away, what do they feel? They feel like the freedom is released from that burden. That's why that if you do viraga, say on thinking, this is just the example, that you experience the freedom from thinking, the silence of the mind. And then you can take up the breath in the silence, and it's easy to keep with it. Does that answer the question? Okay. Oh, you got one, yeah. Go on. I've talked about many different types of sannyas. It's better to develop one type or many types. It's good to develop quite a few. The nature of the mind is that once it uses one particular skillful means, after a while that skillful means becomes dull. And then it's a time to use one of the other skillful means. To be like the kangaroos in this monastery, they graze one area of grass. They don't eat all the grass there, then they move on to another one to give that grass a chance to grow. Now your main object is the anapanasati. And these are different tools which you use from time to time. What some will be you feel more at home with. But if you've got two or three especially which you develop, then you can use them at different times. And you'll find because you use different ones from time to time, the mind won't get like bored, or won't get, the only word I can use is like dull for the use. You often find that if someone gives you like a new meditation technique, or sort of a new skillful means, and you use it straight away, that it's very sharp and you get good results, and after a while it doesn't work. It's just like the mind is not that interested in it. It's not, hasn't got as much chanda to use it as when it's fresh. So I would advise having two or three and using them in some sort of rotation.